Hello, and welcome to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. We are the boyfriends. I'm Billy Ray.
I'm Joel. Thank you for having me.
And today we're discussing Season 7, Episode 11 of Desperate Housewives, Assassins.
Also pronounced arse-arse-ins.
No, it's not. It's really not.
In England, we say arse-arse-ins.
So, welcome back. It's another episode. We're here. And Joel's going to be doing trivia. And I assume you have some stuff to kick us off with.
I always do. So, this episode aired on the 2nd of January 2011 and was written by John Paul Bullock III and directed by David Warren. The title of the episode comes from the Stephen Sondheim musical of the same title, and if you hadn't already guessed, this is the first episode to air in 2011. So, what happened this week, starting on the 27th of December, which was the Monday of the week? Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rules out apologising to Turkey for killing 9 of its citizens during May's Gaza flotilla raid, saying, however, that Israel would express its regret. The interview came after Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman said that Turkey should apologise to Israel for supporting terrorists.
So they won't apologise, but they'll express regret.
Yeah.
Okay.
Israeli archaeologists reportedly discovered human remains from 400,000 years ago, therefore challenging the theory that humans originated in Africa.
Oh, wow. Where did they discover them?
Doesn't say. Sir Elton John and his partner David Furnish become parents after a surrogate mother from California gives birth to their son on Christmas Day. The boy is named Zachary Jackson Levin Furnish John.
John's not really his last name, though.
No, it's not.
Wouldn't it be Furnish Dwight?
Yes, because Elton John isn't his real name, is it?
Okay.
So, whatever. A fire in a New Orleans warehouse kills 8 people and 2 dogs. I know. Most of them homeless artists and musicians.
Oh, God.
It's really sad. The UK government gives the go-ahead to plans to allow popular online petitions to be debated in Parliament within the next year. Cuba commutes the last remaining death sentence on the island. North Korea's state-run television broadcasts its first Western film, Bend It Like Beckham.
That's actually quite an interesting piece of trivia.
I know, Bend It Like Beckham as well was their first Western film. Keira Knightley, good job, girl.
Well, apparently it's a very good film.
Yeah. Italy bans plastic bags. Over 1,000 dead birds and other fowl fall out of the sky in Arkansas after a violent tornado outbreak and hailstorm.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And specialist prison guards and firefighters are sent into Ford Open Prison in West Sussex in the United Kingdom after 40 inmates started a riot. Part of the prison had been destroyed by fire. Do you remember that?
That does ring a bell,
like,
actually.
I remember it being all over the news, like the massive prison riot. So the number one song in the US was Grenade by Bruno Mars.
Okay.
And the number one song in the UK was When We Collide by Matt Cardle.
Oh, X Factor.
Which was a throwback and a half. I read that song and I was like, Jesus, I'd forgot that song existed.
Yeah, me too.
No offense, Matt Cardle, if you're listening. So the top film in the box office this weekend, or the weekend of the episode, was in the US, Little Fockers, and in the UK, Gulliver's Travels.
Gulliver's Travels?
That was with Jack Black.
I was just about to ask.
Yeah, I think it was the Jack Black one, considering the time and what have you. I think it was the Jack Black one, and obviously Little Fockers was the sequel to Meet the Fockers.
I kind of enjoyed that Jack Black film.
Oh, I hated it. But I'm not a fan of Jack Black that much.
Yeah, but, you know, some people are just wrong about things, and that's like, okay about you.
I like some of his movies.
You like School of Rock.
I like School of Rock.
That's what you mean.
Yeah, I love School of Rock. School of Rock's a great film, but it's not a great film for Jack Black. Mm. It's a great film for everybody else that's in it. So, that is all of my trivia for now.
How very exciting. Looking forward to what's coming then. So, previously, Bree proposed that Keith moves in with her right after rejecting his proposal for marriage. Lynette started an interior design business with her questionable friend Renee. Juanita learned the truth about her parents and didn't respond well to Gabby, to say the least. Susan made it clear that she knows about Tom and Renee. And there was also a riot, so Susan was trampled on and Paul was shot.
Yeah.
Strangely, I don't think the riot has a lot of consequences.
It has a lot of consequences for Susan.
For Susan, it does indeed.
And it has a lot of consequences for Bree's garden.
It doesn't have any consequences for Paul. He was just shot, and that had nothing to do with the riot. So
this but Paul, in theory, Paul wasn't the one that started the riot.
No, but I'm just saying that the consequences of the riot were minuscule. It was very strange to have a massive riot, which was so tense, and then follow up the next episode with not really very much going on.
It's also wild to me that, in theory, Brie sort of started the panicked riotness with the gun shoot, and nothing happened with that.
No.
Because she was on her property. She's allowed to just fire a gun in the air and create all of this panic for literally no reason.
Yeah, poor Susan is having the worst season, and then she gets trampled on, and the stuff that happens to her in this episode as a consequence.
Yeah.
But Brie, the most first world middle class problem ever, oh, I've got to redo the garden.
Yeah, I know. And that's my God.
That is the extent of this riot. Craziness. Absolutely crazy. Right, so we open the episode with paramedics have arrived on Wisteria Lane to pick up Paul after he was shot, and detectives begin questioning the residents. Unfortunately for them, this is looking to be a tough case, as everyone they speak to on Wisteria Lane is denying the shooting, but claiming to be pretty happy that he was shot. Brie even claims that she's an expert marksman, so if she had shot Paul, he'd be dead.
This is a great scene.
It really was, and I feel really bad for these detectives.
Oh, absolutely. They've got their work cut out for them. But Brie was brilliant in this scene. She's like, I'm an expert marksman. If I was aiming for Paul Young, he'd be dead.
So yeah, we then see Beth going to see Felicia for the first time since she had that freak out moment, and accuses her of setting up Paul's assassination. However, Felicia denies any knowledge of this. Needless to say that Paul might be the most hated character in the entire show right now. Ever.
Yeah.
Felicia then haggles with a prison officer to get a phone, and we see her phoning someone about the shooting. We cut to the person on the other side of the call, and it's only fucking Mike.
She's genuinely unsure, so she either didn't have anything to do with this, or she is a good actress.
So we're going to start with Susan, because the episode starts with Susan. Susan is in the hospital after being trampled on during the riot in probably the most uncomfortable moment of the last episode for me. And it turns out that the doctors had to remove a kidney as she was bleeding internally. It also transpires that the other kidney is deformed, and so she cannot actually get by without the kidney that they've had to take out because it was doing all the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
The doctor says that Susan will most likely need to be put on dialysis and gives her a pamphlet, which is very
helpful.
Mrs. Pillsbury energy.
Yeah.
Susan actually seems quite shocked about this whole thing and a little confused, and somewhat seems to like blame the doctor for taking out her kidney. She's like, well, you shouldn't have taken it out then.
Yeah, well, I guess because they were like, yeah, we've had to remove your only good kidney.
It was bleeding internally.
Yeah, well, no, but it's the fact that she had, you know, we've all, essentially almost all of us, I'm sure, have two kidneys. And so the fact that she suddenly finds out that actually one of her kidneys really has only been working at 5%. 5%.
It's just such a shame that Susan is the type of person that receives bad news and instantly takes out on whoever's in front of her.
Well, I'm sorry, but Susan's had a wandering spleen and a deformed kidney.
Oh, yeah, she's a mess.
Like, what's up with this bitch's body?
Her body reflects her personality. It's a mess.
The doctors come along and they're like, yeah, it's 5%. It could be fine as long as it doesn't drop any lower, then there may be problems. What, lower than 5%?
Yeah, 5% sounds like you should definitely do something about it.
Absolutely.
So doing her very best Karen impression as a patient, someone walks into the room and Susan just demands, please, no more meds. Only to find that it's actually Mike and not a doctor.
Yeah, and he comes in and he's like, I'm good for what ails you.
I've been saying that Mike is really boring recently, but it was actually really nice to see
him. It was really nice to see him.
They hug and he asks how she is and then tells her dialysis isn't as bad as it sounds, only for her to say that she won't be doing it. She says the doctors don't know everything and she doesn't want to be hooked up to a machine for 6 hours a day, 4 days a week, and says that she'll be trying some herbal remedies that she's found online.
She's gone down a Dr. Google rabbit hole.
She's gooping.
She is. She's gooped. She has gooped.
Mike supports her, but he does look concerned.
Well, yeah, when you've got something as serious as this and Susan's there like, I want to try this holistically.
I get that Mike is trying to cheer her up, but when he says it's not as bad as it sounds and she says 6 hours a day, 4 days a week, it's like, well, how much worse could it be?
Yeah, I know. And to be fair, Mike isn't really in a position to sit there and say, dialysis isn't that bad. Bitch, when did you have dialysis?
Yeah, also, she's the one that's here taking care of MJ.
Yeah.
So Mike and MJ are with Susan in the hospital, and Mike is trying to get through to a specialist doctor to talk to Susan. He then leaves the room to try and get a better signal. MJ asks how much longer she'll be in the hospital and asks if she needs a kidney to live, to which she says yes, and MJ starts to worry that Susan is going to die. Seeing that he's clearly upset, she offers to go to the cafeteria with him to get ice cream and gets out of bed. In my head, I was like, hopefully this is actually getting through to her and maybe she'll take this dialysis thing a bit more seriously. The nurse starts protesting and even offers to get an orderly to bring her a wheelchair, but Susan says that she doesn't need one and that she has to do this.
Because MJ's getting scared. I think it's a really sweet mother moment for Susan.
It is sweet, but it's very dramatic and completely unnecessary. Like, just listen to your nurse.
Yeah.
She doesn't get very far with MJ until she starts feeling dizzy and falls to the ground and starts having a fit. Definitely scaring him even more than he was if she had just got the damn wheelchair.
Yeah, I know. Like, it's a sweet mother moment from her, but in the end, she ends up scaring him anyway, even though that's exactly what she was trying to avoid.
Like, I feel bad for Susan, but she's been such a Karen this episode and so stupid, and she's just making herself worse, and she's making things worse for everyone.
Well, she's just not admitting to herself how bad the situation is. It's just going to take some time.
So she's having a bad time.
She is, yeah.
Last scene for Susan.
Yep.
The ladies visit Susan in the hospital and she tells them what's happening with her and that she needs dialysis until the doctors can find a donor. And then she drops the bombshell that it could take 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
She then asks that if something happens to her to make sure that there's someone there for Mike and MJ, but they just tell her that she's going to come out with flying colors and she'll be fine.
Yeah.
But Lynette, the one who has gone through cancer, and clearly in this look exchange, we can tell understands what Susan needs to hear.
Yeah.
Promises that she will.
Yeah, it's a really nice friendship moment. You always have those friends that are like, you're going to be fine, you're going to be fine, like, don't worry about it. But sometimes you'll just need that friend to just listen to us and say, yeah.
It's also a really nice way for the writers to play back on the fans' memories of things that have happened in the show and the life events that have taken place with these characters, so that you can see that Lynette understands exactly what Susan's asking and what she's going through, because Lynette has been in a situation where she's had to think, if I die, who's going to take care of my family?
Yeah.
So it's like, it was a sweet scene.
It's like in the previous episode when Gabby goes to Lynette to talk to her about losing a child.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, so Susan says in this scene 3 to 5 years for on the wait for a kidney transplant. Now, that's America. I've done trivia on UK. So kidneys, if you have a living donor, it usually takes 3 to 6 months in the UK to have the required tests and all of that sort of stuff. But if you're waiting for a deceased donor, it can take 2 to 3 years. Lungs, so the average wait for a lung transplant in the UK is 18 months. Heart, the average wait for a deceased donor for heart transplant in the UK, really it depends on how unwell you are and whether you're on the urgent or super urgent list, because really it's a heart, so there's only those two lists, really.
Urgent and super urgent.
Yeah. Patients on the super urgent list have the shortest wait, but they do tend to be those that are critically ill, and it also depends on the blood group, height and weight, so actually they can't really give a date with regards to heart transplants. So the liver, the average wait for a liver transplant is 3 to 4 months. And for the pancreas, the average wait for the pancreas transplant is 1 year. However, for a pancreas, you can only have a donor from a deceased parent.
Yeah, like,
because obviously we've only got one pancreas.
No offense, but do you need a pancreas transplant?
I mean, you're getting by without working one.
Right.
So yeah, at the moment, significantly less times than what Susan is declaring. But in the UK, there are significantly more people that need organs than there are donors. But yeah, that's why I think they push people a lot to get onto the donor list.
Now, as we were talking about supportive Lynette, let's move on to Lynette and Renee's story.
Yeah.
So Renee visits Susan in hospital. Oh yeah, we're still talking about Susan though as well.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And offers her kidney in exchange for Susan's silence.
Mm.
For some reason, Susan doesn't take this offer up though. But she says not to worry, as she won't be telling Lynette, as being trampled was really what made her start to think about stuff.
Renee, what I will say is, Renee's hair has so much volume that it looks like she's been blasted in the face with a leaf blower.
Maybe there's a kidney in there.
And I she's got them all up in there. And I say that with love. Like, yeah. I love her hair, but it's got so much volume at the front, like it really flicks up and out, that yeah, it just looks like someone's just quickly walked on before they've shot the scene and blasted her in the face.
Yeah. She tells her it's up to Renee to tell Lynette. We then have Renee on the lane and she talks to Tom and tells him the whole situation. If her friendship with Lynette is real, unlike all the friends who she has lost contact with over the years, she has to tell Lynette. Tom, however, disagrees and says that friendships are built on lies and tells her not to tell Lynette.
Of course.
And they leave on a questionable note. Will she? Won't she?
Yeah, I mean, what Susan has said has suddenly got to Renee, even though Susan essentially said the same thing in the last episode. But I guess when it comes from someone in a hospital bed, you take it to heart more.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
But Tom is literally looking out for number one.
So Lynette and Renee are with a client pitching an idea for a hotel interior design, and basically they nail it.
Yeah, they're really in sync.
The client responds well and says that she can tell that they've been friends for years. 26 to be exact. Hearing this seems to make Renee feel guilty. Lynette leaves the table for water and Renee continues with the speech. When Lynette returns, she brings oatmeal cookies for Renee, because apparently Renee loves these oatmeal cookies.
Oatmeal raisin.
Ugh. And Renee gives this guilty but appreciative look and then starts crying.
They've really made Renee out to be the crybaby of the season, haven't they?
She's having a hard time.
She's this is like the second time she's cried so far this season. And it won't be the last, trust me. Okay.
She calls Lynette a great friend and then she really starts crying. So Lynette tells the client to take the drawings and that they'll talk more next week. Lynette says, what the hell? And Renee opens up about her affair with Tom in the restaurant. Brave.
In the restaurant. And this is where Lynette basically says, when was this? Oh, we were engaged.
This is interesting because most people would think, we're in a restaurant, we're in public, what's she going to do? But this is Lynette.
Yeah.
So Lynette, destroyer of worlds, looks so pissed off in this scene. And I would run for the hills. I would change my name. I would find a cabin in the middle of nowhere because I've seen what Lynette can do.
Yeah, but Lynette doesn't really do anything. She's actually quite calm for the scene. Like, she's in a restaurant. We've seen worse scenes in Desperate Housewives in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Including Renee.
Break.
Like, yeah. which also include Renee. Renee and restaurants really don't work very well together.
Mm.
But in this scene, Lynette literally is just like, I can't even look at you.
Yeah, she's very calm, but it sometimes takes a while for things to sink in.
Oh, of course it does. And something as big as this coming from someone that you think is a close friend and business partner.
That's rough.
Like, what do you
we
do?
We said that was a bad idea. Oh, we
of course.
Said that.
Yeah, but subconsciously, it's because I think we knew what was coming. But how are you supposed to handle this situation now? That's my best friend and my business partner.
It wasn't subconsciously because we knew what was coming. It was because it was before she announced the business that we found out that she had cheated with Tom.
Oh, yeah.
Needless to say, she isn't pleased, but Renee is her lift home.
Yeah, she comes storming back.
So in the car, Lynette tells her that she does hate her a lot, but in the future, maybe she can see herself hating her only a little, which is actually quite nice and a bit more nice than you have to be in this situation.
Oh yeah, Lynette's a very big woman for being able to just sort of sit there and say, I envision a future where I can forgive you. I couldn't do that when I went, I've spoken about being in a similar situation, so I won't go into it again, but I wasn't like this.
We haven't been for anywhere near as much as Lynette, though, have we? So Lynette probably has a very different outlook on life with these things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, I've not been held at gunpoint, nor have I had cancer, thank God.
Nor have we been shot, nor have we seen a house go down in a tornado, which we think our family's in.
Yeah.
So she says that the worst thing is that they've been knowing about this for years, and Lynette has just been oblivious to it. Lynette then asks Renee not to tell Tom about this conversation, and clearly she's brewing a little plan.
Yeah, even Renee questions why.
Later, Tom gets home while Lynette is cooking and tells her that he had the worst day. She somewhat plays along with it as if nothing's wrong and then starts saying about how amazing Renee is as they talk about getting this client. She offers Tom some hot cocoa to try it, saying, oh, it might be a little cold. So Tom takes a bit of a gulp of it and burns his tongue on the hot drink. It's scalding, Lynette. And she then walks away smiling at her deviousness.
Well, she loves the fact that she just caused him pain. What do you mean that Lynette played along? Lynette did not play along. Tom is just so narcissistic that he could not notice that Lynette really didn't give a shit about anything he said when he walked through that door.
That's also true. But what I mean is, he's just talking about his day and she's like, oh, really? Oh, no. Tell me about it. Oh.
Yeah, she's literally just like, yeah, wow.
This whole burning your tongue on the hot chocolate thing, it was so devious and twisted, and I just really loved it. It was very funny.
She was testing him right before this moment when she obviously said, me and Renee landed that client. She turned to Tom and said, it was all Renee. She's an amazing woman. And if Tom, I can guarantee you, if Tom had said something about it then, I mean, why would he? But if he'd said something about it then, Lynette wouldn't have burnt him.
Well, she might have thrown it on him.
Well, yeah.
People get stuff thrown on them a lot in this show.
Especially in this house.
But needless to say, I think Lynette's plan is to, until Tom eventually talks about this, she's just going to torture him.
Yeah, that one, she's probably just going to sort of do a, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime sort of thing, and just punish him until she sees it as fit.
Yeah, maybe. So now let's move on to a story that's not quite as funny, which is Gabby's.
Yeah.
Gabby is shopping with Juanita to buy her a doll, and we have a clip.
Welcome to Miss Charlotte's Doll Academy. I'm Miss Charlotte. How can I serve you today?
We are here to buy a doll.
Oh, I'm sorry. We don't sell dolls here.
Really? Wow, this place got creepy fast.
But I do let good little girls adopt some of my friends. Are you ready to be a mommy?
I don't care.
For everyone listening, Joel hasn't stopped quoting this clip for a week.
Years. This is what I say this all the time. What would you want about a week?
That's
literally
true.
You said to me a couple of weeks ago, where is that from? When I said, I don't care.
I assumed it was like The Simpsons or something.
He always assumes it's The Simpsons when I say something that he doesn't get. And then it was only last night where I was just like, oh, you'll see soon because we'll talk about it. It's in the clip. Like,
also, as Joel very candidly pointed out during the clip, I'm saying the word doll very strangely and I'm trying my best, but I find it a very difficult word to say. Doll.
Doll.
Doll. Juanita isn't being particularly responsive to the whole situation, and so Gabby apologizes and says that she's just trying to prove how much that she loves her. The shop assistant then brings a doll over for approval, and Juanita seems to love it, so the shop assistant prepares the papers.
And also, she shows the doll to Juanita, and she gives off the whole backstory, Princess Charlotte or something like that, and she says, the fur is real ermine. So, ermine? What is an ermine?
Isn't it some sort of, I don't know what you'd call that kind of animal, but sort of like a ferret or a weasel, you know, that kind of thing?
It's a weasel. So an ermine is a weasel, and they feed on small mammals, birds, eggs, frogs, and occasional invertebrate. And in summer, the ermine is brown with a whitish throat, chest, and belly. And in colder climates, the winter coat is white, except for the black tail tip.
What? They change colour?
In moderately cold climates, the fur becomes only partly white.
So they're like those mugs where you pour hot water in and they change.
Yes. So anyway, the winter-taken pelts, prized for finesse and pure colour, are among the most valuable of commercial furs and are obtained mainly in northern Eurasia. During the reign of Edward III, which ran from 1327 to 1377, the wearing of ermine was restricted to members of the royal family, and thereafter, state robes were constructed in such a way that in many cases, the rank and position of the wearer could be determined by the presence or absence or disposition of the black spots.
Cool. So this is a very rare fur.
Yeah.
So and when it has a historical significance for royalty.
So when you see like the robes and stuff that the royal family wear and they've got like that fur trim with the black dots around, that's ermine.
Hmm. So Gabby gets her phone out to take a picture and becomes sad at seeing a photo of Grace on her screen, which just pisses off Juanita, who does a walkout.
She does do a walkout.
So Gabby and Carlos have taken Juanita to get therapy and they're in the waiting room at the moment. It's a very awkward scene.
Yeah, and Gabby's trying to make jokes.
So Gabby is talking and Carlos is just silent, absolutely letting the resentment simmer.
Yeah, he's heating up that room with his resentment alone.
Yeah, he does look quite hot.
He really does.
Gabby asks how many times she has to say sorry, but Carlos claims that he just wants to heal the damage done to Juanita. The therapist then calls them in while Juanita waits outside. In the office, the therapist says that Juanita is confused as she knows Carmen and Hector are her biological parents, but she doesn't actually feel anything towards them. But Gabby feels so much love for Grace. So there's a weird dichotomy in her mind.
Yeah, Juanita doesn't quite get why.
She then tells them that they need to remove Grace from their lives completely for Juanita to heal. So photos, artwork, the whole shebang. Gabby seems reluctant, but Carlos says that they'll do whatever it takes.
I just don't know. I mean, I'm not qualified, so don't take my word or don't take my comments on any of this like as gospel, but I'm not sure if I trust this therapist's opinion on how to handle the situation. I think maybe the therapist just worded it wrong, but what she said was to essentially erase Grace's existence so Juanita can feel like she's the most important thing in Gabby's world now. But Juanita will never be the most important thing in Gabby's world because Celia exists.
Exactly.
So actually, we shouldn't be allowing a child to sit there and believe that they are the center of the universe. And it sounds quite egomaniacal to do that.
Also, do we have to heal the child by completely harming the mum?
Exactly.
Like, Carlos seems absolutely fine, but he seriously needs therapy. Look at him.
Like, I get what the therapist means. I get that obviously Juanita now feels a confliction and probably a little bit of a hatred towards Grace, which, to be fair, we saw Juanita feel that
when she was getting all the attention.
Yeah. So, and it is only natural for Juanita to sort of be confused and struggling with her feelings in that regard. But I just think that completely erasing Grace's existence when you can clearly see that even the thought of it seems to be almost sending Gabby over an edge.
Yeah. At home, Carlos calls Gabby into the bedroom to ask why she still has photos of Grace around, to which she apologizes and says that she's been busy. She wants to hide the photos, but Carlos insists that they throw them away so that Juanita doesn't find them, because Juanita does have a habit of finding things.
Yeah.
She then says that she'll hide them in the bank, like in a safe lock thing.
Girls don't play at the bank.
But Carlos starts shouting at her and tells her that they have to remove them completely.
It's a tough scene to watch.
Yeah, it's rough. He then takes her phone to delete the her photos on the phone and yells that Juanita is unhappy because Gabby failed to protect her. Gabby then asks, am I just supposed to pretend she doesn't exist? And Carlos says, yes. And that this is the last time Gabby will ever mention Grace's name in this house.
And like, every man in this episode, except for Orson, and we'll get to that, is putting his foot down.
But this scene made me so uncomfortable and angry.
Because you can see Gabby starting to lose control. You can see it behind the eyes, and it's so sad.
It's like he's just completely either blind or oblivious to her pain.
Yeah.
And it's like, I get it, you're thinking about your daughter, but you don't have to disregard your wife at the same time.
No, like, we do, Carlos is focusing on Juanita, and so because of that, he may not be seeing Gabby's pain. Carlos did always say from the very beginning, the minute they found out that Juanita was not really their biological daughter, that if they proceed down this road, Juanita could get hurt, and the minute Juanita starts to get hurt, they need to pull away, because Juanita is the priority. So Carlos has always had Juanita's emotional mental health as number one priority,
which I love.
But it's just now that, yes, the very thing that Carlos was worried about is actually happening, and okay, yes, Carlos was right and blah blah blah, but yeah, you don't discredit your wife.
So it's Juanita's birthday, and she's having a big party with all of her friends, and they're all singing happy birthday. One of the mums then makes conversation with Gabby and asks if she has any other children besides Juanita and Celia, and after a moment Gabby says no. And the heartbreak on her face, the sad music, the works.
Yeah, I know. And if, like, it's so sad, and clearly it's a lie. And if I asked a woman a question, well, not even just a woman, anyone really, but obviously in this instance, it's a woman. If I asked a woman a question and she said no to me like that, I'd be like, why are you lying?
This is the first moment where Gabby has taken that whole erasing Grace thing into consideration. This is the first action that we see.
Yeah, where she has legitimately had to lie to herself and everyone else.
But I think literally just uttering the words has broken her, as we see in the next scene.
Yeah.
Gabby is now at the doll store. Doll store? Doll?
The doll store.
Gabby is now at the store with the China toy thingies to adopt one of the China toy thingies. The shop assistant says that Juanita is a lucky girl, but Gabby says that the doll, is for her. And she begins stroking the doll's cheek. We then cut to a sort of more close-up shot of the doll, and basically it looks like Grace.
It does. Yeah, like this, I've been waiting for this storyline since we started doing the podcast. Like, I find this to be probably one of the hardest storylines in Desperate Housewives to watch.
Yeah, you've been saying that a lot about this storyline and that you're really looking forward to it. I haven't been looking forward to it because I find it really difficult to watch. It's just a bit much for me.
I find it hard to watch to see this poor woman slowly be broken down.
So let's move on to Bree. Bree and Keith seem to have made up and picked up where they left off. That's it.
Bree carried Keith in at the end to the house at the end of the last episode, and that's that.
Yeah, don't ask questions. Keith is gardening for her, and Bree is drinking out of a bottle rather than a glass. It's very cute. They're like picking up on each other's things.
Yeah.
So we go inside to find that Bree has started unpacking some of Keith's things in a very Bree kind of way, as she's tidied it all, but she's also thrown a bunch of stuff away that she doesn't like.
And Keith is so calm about it.
He's like, where's my lava lamp? Oh, it just seems to have fallen on the floor and shattered, and I had to throw it away.
I threw it away when I accidentally knocked it off the side, and there was that other thing as well. There was a lava lamp, and there was his beanbag chair. Oh, sadly went in the trash after I stuck a knife in it.
Yeah.
And Keith's just like, ha ha ha.
So they seem to be doing well, as Bree says everything that's happened recently has made her more appreciative of him. Orson then randomly shows up at the door and says that Judy kicked him out.
Ugh, Orson, gross.
Asks if he can stay with Bree. Well, Bree and Keith.
Which Bree then says yes to, by the way.
He's ruining move-in day.
And what is it with Bree just inviting people without considering how Keith feels about it? Now, if I was Keith, that would be a massive red flag for me.
Yeah, but like, sorry, but don't I live here now?
First it's my dad. Then it's someone that's also old enough to be my dad.
So Orson is discussing the disillusion of his stupid relationship, and Keith asks roughly how long Orson's going to be staying. The situation's very tense, and the men don't seem to like each other very much, but they are from different worlds.
Very different worlds.
Keith then leaves to shower, and Orson just says, interesting choice.
Mm.
And judges Bree for having her move on with him.
He's just jealous.
And you know what? The fucking audacity. How quickly did he move on with Judy?
Right?
He then makes fun of her for how young Keith is and his interests, but Bree says that she has changed since meeting Keith. Keith then sees Orson calling her perfect and touching her cheek from a distance.
Inappropriate.
Yeah.
And creepy. Clearly creepy. What makes you think you can just wheel your way back into my house and start touching me?
Orson is at the dinner table and Bree has made his favourite dinner, coq au vin.
Coq au vin.
Keith then walks in wearing another white vest top, confused as he thought they were having sloppy joes. But Bree says that she wanted to make something more elegant for their guest.
At the beginning of this scene as well, Orson also kisses Bree on the hand.
Yeah, he needs to be stopped.
And it's like, Bree, it's so inappropriate for Bree to be allowing this to happen as well.
Yeah. As we've mentioned in a previous episode, Bree seems to be very oblivious to the things that she does and the things that happen around her.
It's all just a little bit romantic. Like, I would feel uncomfortable if I walked into the room and saw somebody cupping your cheek with their hands or kissing your, you know, your hand.
Especially an ex.
Yeah.
Orson then does a toast and recites a poem, leading to Keith getting annoyed and reciting his own poem, which is just shut up and eat.
Yeah.
Keith and Orson then start subtly going at each other, except it's not really that subtle.
Yeah, with Bree or Orson calling him Stanley Kowalski.
Yeah, I don't know who that is.
So Stanley Kowalski, even though Bree is there saying, oh, he wore a lot of vests and stuff, Bree needs to say how it is. Okay, Stanley Kowalski wore a lot of vests and was a physically abusive asshole and mentally and sexually abusive to his wife's sister, who ended up having a breakdown. Now, Stanley Kowalski is a character from a play, A Streetcar Named Desire, written by Tennessee Williams.
Oh, right. That's more Orson's vibe.
Yeah.
So Orson makes fun of him for not wearing a shirt, and then Bree asks if Keith can put on a shirt.
Which is ridiculous as well.
Yeah, why should he have to...
This is like, his home.
I mean, I know you have guests over, but like, calm down. It's a vest top.
He's allowed to feel comfortable. Like, oh my God, it was so... I would be fuming if I was Keith.
However, I do think that this was interesting because it's the first moment where this sort of thing had to be brought up for Bree and Keith in this relationship, because he is the kind of guy that would eat dinner in a vest. She's not the kind of gal that would eat dinner in not a shirt.
I was interested in this story to see Bree sort of battle with old Bree and new Bree.
Yeah, like they take up each other's ways of doing things a lot, but this is like a very different world, the dinner table, for both of them, isn't it?
I think it shocked Keith having somebody from Bree's old life suddenly come back in a way that is probably almost scary for Keith, because it's like, oh my God, what if Bree suddenly, now that Orson's back in her life, realizes, oh, actually, I miss the old Bree.
Mm.
You know, the fancy dinners and the opera, and has a boyfriend that wears vests at the dinner table.
Yeah. He gets annoyed about this, and then after some more passive-aggressive banter, Keith flicks mash at Orson.
I'm just pleased it wasn't his own feces.
Bree is horrified, and then Orson flicks peas at Keith, and then they just have a food fight.
Yeah.
And Bree's just horrified, and she leaves.
I mean, you would be too. Bree, of course, I wouldn't really understand, because I don't cook. Bree does all the cooking. But if Bree was to cook me a lovely meal, and then I start flinging it around everywhere, it would be pretty devo too, I imagine.
I mean, this is a classy lady as well. Yes. This is atrocious.
And again, this is another episode, two in a row, where we see somebody stooping to the level of the person that they're essentially judging.
Yeah, Orson is supposed to, at least in his mind, be better than this.
Yeah.
So what does that tell you about Orson, really?
Exactly.
Later, Bree goes to visit Judy out of the blue and asks her to take him back and let him stay until he finds a new place. She then reveals that Orson actually left her and that it's because he's still in love with Bree.
Which does make sense, considering that when Judy answered the door and since then, her conversations with Bree have been quite blunt.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, Judy doesn't really seem to like Bree. And this is probably why. It's because she's been dumped by Orson because he's still in love with Bree.
Yeah, this is awkward. I mean, she doesn't really have a character, but...
Judy doesn't, no.
Poor Judy.
Yeah, poor Judy.
So she goes back home and Keith apologises for everything, saying that clearly it's all platonic. And Bree says, actually, no, he is still in love with me. So Keith is ready to throw him out and Bree says that she'll talk to him about finding somewhere else. She approaches Orson and tells him that she spoke with Judy about everything. And Orson doesn't deny any of it, saying that he made a big mistake. He hopes Bree feels the same way and that she will be his wife again. But Bree says that she's made a new connection now and that she's changed. She tells him he'll always have a piece of her heart, but to accept that it's over. But he says he'll never give up.
Right. Oh, I should never have left you and blah, blah, blah. It's just such a creep. You honestly expect her to just wheel your way back into this house and just have Bree suddenly become your wife again.
Yeah, it's not a good look.
No, it's not. It's just, it's his entitlement and sexism is showing.
Keith is annoyed, which makes sense, and says that she is still in love with Orson, and he does a walkout. Bree chases him, jumps on him, they roll in the wet mud for a little bit, and then Bree tells him that she wants this relationship to work and hopes that this proves it, and they both laugh and kiss.
I would like to point out it's not mud, it's shit.
Oh yeah, it's manure or something. It's manure. Isn't it? She's literally rolling around in manure for this guy.
Like, I don't care how hot Keith is, there is not a situation in the world that would call for me rolling around in manure.
But she is showing that she's changing, she wants him, she's going to do things to get him to stay.
Like, she's barefoot as well.
So I can see why a lot of people wanted these two to be endgame.
Oh, yeah.
That's it.
That's it. Yeah.
That's Bree. So let's move on to the last part of the episode, which is Paul.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Paul is in the hospital with Beth and he gets a visit from the detectives. They ask Paul who had a motive to shoot him and he tells them all of them. But they say everyone has a motive. Much to Beth's surprise, they then say that they need to ask her a few questions, but Paul insists that Beth is not a suspect and she's the only person he can trust. Oh, the dramatic irony.
If I was Beth, I would be freaking out right now because number one suspect is always the spouse, whether it's Beth or not, always the spouse is number one.
So now might be a good time to bring up the Felicia of it all.
Yeah, because ultimately it will be found out because the police will look into your past.
But she's not very bright.
She's very sheltered. I don't think she's watched a single murder documentary in her life. She doesn't know what the police probably do.
Yeah. So they ask if Beth can think of anyone who'd want Paul dead, but she says no, because apparently she hasn't been on this lane.
Yeah, no, I think they just mean like anybody else.
Yeah, true. Upon leaving, the detectives then say, did you catch the look on the wife's face?
Mm-hmm.
A clear indication that she is definitely a person of interest.
Yeah, that was her chance to bring up Felicia. And the fact that she didn't also now means they suspect her.
But she should bring up Felicia now. The detectives have gone. Yeah. You're alone. You should bring this up before... Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mike visits Felicia in prison and says that it wasn't him who shot Paul. So, okay, thank God.
Yeah.
It was quite a gag when Mike picked up the phone, but then this was a nice relief.
Yeah.
He also says that he only said he'd think about it, but that he never would actually have shot Paul.
It's interesting because in the previous scene with Beth, Felicia's argument to Beth when she was like, it wasn't me, I didn't do it, was all my entire process has been to get him to admit to the murder of my sister. Why would I have him killed before he could do that? Mm-hmm. But in this scene, she asked Mike to kill him.
Yeah.
So actually, did you not really care about him admitting to the murder to Martha?
Well, I think she did, but she might just be lying to try and assuage Beth.
Probably.
Or the writers didn't quite know what they were doing.
Maybe.
Who can say? So this leaves Felicia confused as to who it was that shot him. Then, at the hospital, the detectives walk into Paul's hospital room and say that when they asked about any enemies that he might have, he failed to mention his mother-in-law.
Yeah.
So this obviously confuses Paul, who doesn't even know his mother-in-law, until the detectives say, why didn't you tell us that your mother-in-law framed you for murder?
Gag. Like, Paul, oh my God, the gag of it all.
Yeah, so Paul is clearly shocked, but he acts casual and says it's all water under the bridge, and that him and Felicia resolved their issues.
With love and prayer or something, wasn't it?
Some bollocks.
With love and prayer, Felicia Tillman and I have moved forward or something, but Paul really can't lie to save his life.
Right, we made up in a prison visiting room or something.
It's just the fact that when they mention Felicia, Paul has this big long pause where you can clearly see he's trying to think of an answer to get out of this without obviously saying the wrong thing and fucking up his plan, any future plans, because he's now thinking about how to get Beth.
Yeah, but it's, you have to suspend your disbelief, because I think it's for the camera.
You do, of course it is. Yeah. It's for dramatic effect and what have you, but Paul really can't lie to save his life, clearly.
No. The detectives seem convinced enough and they leave him to it. So while Beth is not in the room, he's probably thinking of ways to kill her.
Yeah.
And that is where the episode ends. Mm-hmm. That was the end. So let's move on to our next part of the show, where Joel's going to give us the gayest and the straightest moments of the episode. So what do you have for the gayest moment of this episode?
So my award for gayest moment goes to Gabby for returning to the doll shop. Like, I know she's having a breakdown, so it's not really supposed to be a cute moment, but it's very gay 8-year-old wanting nothing more than, like, a Barbie for Christmas.
Yeah, I get that. And this is, like, the fanciest version that you could possibly get, right?
Exactly. And so
sell dolls here.
She goes back to the doll shop and then she gets that doll in her arms and it's like she's complete for the first time in her life.
Yeah. And then what do you have for the straightest moment?
My award for straightest moment goes to Orson for just wheeling himself back into Bree's life and wanting her to fall back into the role of dutiful wife.
I know. Crazy.
It's so sexist and weird and creepy.
Literally wheeling back in and be like, I'm back.
I'm back. Where's my cocker van?
Yep, let's get back to normal.
Yeah. I'm ready to go see Madame Butterfly at the opera.
Pot roast now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are my awards for this episode. And now we move on to Bee's awards. So who do you have for the best and worst parent? Or who do you have for the best parent?
So my award for
best parent of the episode
goes to Mike for returning to the lane to check on Susan and MJ after the riot.
Yay!
It was sweet, and it was really nice to see him again.
It was nice to see him again, but I very much imagined that he was just going to do that anyway.
Well, yeah, but who else am I going to give it to?
Susan for going to take MJ for ice cream.
What, and then collapsing into a fit and scaring him even more? I don't think so. That was her own stupidity.
Okay. And who do you have for the worst parent of the episode?
My award for
worst parent of the episode
goes to Susan for not following doctor's orders, leading to her having a fit and scaring MJ more than he already was.
Yeah, you should really listen to your doctor.
Especially when your kids are right there. What kind of precedent are you setting?
Yeah.
What kind of example is that? I'm not listening to you. Who are you?
It's all very well and good if you want to try some more sort of herbal remedies and things, but guys, really run them past your doctor first before you start looking into other types of medicine.
Yeah, herbal remedies aren't a replacement for actual medicines and therapies and treatments.
No.
So that was Season 7, Episode 11, Assassins. If anyone has any questions, queries, comments or theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at boyfriendsreview.
You can also email us with our email boyfriendsreview@outlook.com. And our friend Louis does the artwork and you can get him on Instagram at DocRedMonkDesign. There is a link to his Etsy page and he does also do commissions. So you can get yourself, I don't know, like some artwork made and make that into a present. Who knows? Now that Christmas is on the way.
It is. We're in December now.
Join us next time when we'll be back in your ear holes with Season 7, Episode 12, Where Do I Belong? So, see you then, guys.
See you then.
Bye.